The Future of Contemporary Art, followed by the Philip K. Dick Story Hour with Eric Davis, followed by myself, Mark Pesce, talking about the future of us, closing with Dale and Laura Pendel talking about the pathetic fallacy and some poems. The pathetic fallacy, which was a topic that came up yesterday when the Wallace Stevens stuff was going on. And Dale thought that might be a really good topic to riff off of, so I think they'll be talking about imagery and stuff like that. Okay, so without further ado, I'm very happy to present a very good friend of mine and someone that I personally de-virginized.
And boy, did it hurt.
Gregory P.
Okay. Now, I just want to start with a little caveat emptor. I got a call about this about a week ago from Mark. I got some email. He said, can you do this? And I said, sure, that's a week away. No problem. But I forgot that between here and there was like planning for Burning Man, getting to Burning Man, et cetera, et cetera. So generally speaking, I like to do these things where I write stuff out and I make 3x5 cards and I memorize the whole thing and I speak, but it's not going to work that way today. So today it's going to be more of a reading than a talk. If you must intersperse, do so. But it's more or less a reading on the topic at hand. So, and we shall begin with the clang of the gong. More time needed, but that's always the case here. We're a time-based art world here, because the time is always ticking down towards the end, the singularity, the denouement of the festival. To paraphrase Mark Pesce's talk yesterday, we know our expiration date at Burning Man, which lends to all of our works here a sense of immediacy that could make any situationist proud. In 1587, a hardy band of New World settlers made their way to Roanoke Island off the coast of South Carolina. With 171 men, women, and children, the colony seemed much too large to die out and disappear in the space of a year. But when supply ships arrived in Roanoke in 1588, they simply found no one there. Plates were still set for meals. There was no sign of struggle, and yet all were gone. A note was found reading, "Gone to Croatoan." The word Croatoan was found carved into a nearby tree. Since that time, Croatoan has gone on to become a metaphor within underground and alternative cultures throughout the Americas. The notion was solidified with the publication of Kayleen and Solosky's book, Gone to Croatoan, Origins of North American Dropout Culture. The book, which chronicles various alternative settlements and modes of living throughout the United States prior to the 20th century, would be at home on the shelf of most people in this room, certainly mine, alongside texts such as the Whole Earth Catalog, the Illuminatus Trilogy, Lipstick Traces, and of course, Hakim Bey's The Temporary Autonomous Zone, which unlike the Croatoan's book, the Croatoan's historical nature is a projection of a future culture, a blueprint that perhaps the founders of Burning Man, and certainly today's participants, use in creating this community each year. In the summer of 2000, following the last major art piece on a non-native artist I've ever written since, I was mysteriously awarded an intriguing grant. Standing naked poolside at Murray Gilman's house in Santa Fe at a party where hundreds drank sangria and marveled at the opulent art collection of the discoverer of the quark, a young woman approached me and invited me to spend 6 weeks inside the Waterman Contemporary Library of Contemporary Art. I took the offer and flew to New York City, sleeping on the couch of this esteemed collection, housed in an unassuming six-story loft in Soho, not too far from the building that was filled with dirt for an earthworks project in the 70s, and still remains filled with dirt in the highest rental district in the country. In a way, it was all I needed to see about the New York art world to remind me I wanted no part of it. The collection, however, has an overwhelming and mostly private treasure of over 3,000 volumes on and about art of the 20th century, including such texts as Marcel Duchamp's handwritten diaries, reams of letters written by Salvador Dali to Gala, piles of situationist surrealism and Dada pamphlets and screeds, as well as more pedestrian tomes like a lovely first edition of Clarence Green's first book, Tom Wolfe's Bauhaus to Our House, and stacks and stacks and stacks and stacks of New York art catalogs on artists ranging from James Lee Byers to Yoko Ono. I slept on the couch and just stared, mostly, at the books before me, the backs of them with their titles tempting me to read of times gone by, The Truth of Fluxus, The Lies of Dada, Tristan Zara Speaks, wondering all the while, as people do, how on earth it was possible that it seemed at one time that art had something pressing and vital to offer to the time in which it was made, and why now it all seemed like just such total dross, an opening to attend, a friend to congratulate, a piece to buy for the sake of it in hopes the artist might someday find a voice and have something interesting to say with it. Not that I hadn't seen and championed a couple of artists along the way, most notably Erica Wanamaker, a witchy lady who likes to scavenge items from the dark, dreary mountains of Los Alamos and transform fantastic artifacts into objects for peace, her alchemical process burning bright with tiny little doses of Datura, often not even taken, but simply resonating in her humble little chamber near a cold water street in the heart of Santa Fe. I spent a lot of my time there walking the streets, making a zine, visiting one strange Chelsea gallery after another, looking for something approaching real art. The closest I got to truth the entire time I was in New York was on one fortuitous day spent inside the Dia Foundation at a Bruce Nauman show, watching his kinetic dog sculpture and fence digging videos with his granddaughter Sophie and his son Eric, whom I'd gone to high school with, and I asked him, "Have you ever figured out why your dad is such a famous artist?" And he smiled and said, "It's just like Hollywood, right place, right time." And I can't tell you how grateful I was that someone didn't try to sham me with some absurd lie about how damn important and meaningful all this silly work is. I remember the day I knew for certain that I would soon walk away from this world forever. It was a delightfully crisp day in August, and I was walking the streets of the Chelsea district, but a stone's throw from the Hudson River, this fabled neighborhoods of galleries for the young and the hip, and I chanced into a street-level space. Red dots greeted me from titled placards, and the walls were covered with canvases and photographs with a palette of gray, brown, and black, murky images, each one containing the word self-portrait somewhere in their title. The artist's name was KM, simply KM, though I knew the name was Kelly, and I knew that she was female. And as my pupils flitted frantically from one piece to the next, searching for richer content, an autobiographical sketch of the artist in front of me began to form in my very back brain. It read a little something like this. My name is Kelly. I'm from Westchester County. My father is an investment banker. My mother is involved in local politics in the Historic Preservation Society. I went to private schools. When I was 16, my father caught me in bed with my girlfriend and called me a dirty whore, then brought me a tennis bracelet, which I promptly threw away. I have no culture. I have no culture. I have no culture. I went to Vassar to major in women's studies, but all women's history was less interesting to me than my own self-expression, so I switched to studio. I went to Parsons and continued to paint here in New York, occasional jobs in graphic design, but mostly living off my trust fund. I have no culture, I have no culture, I have no culture. I've read all the books that I was supposed to read as an artistic radical, but I sold them on the sidewalk when I graduated. I'm not down with the male-dominated, patriarchal, consumerist, capitalist culture, but my work is more important than all of that, at least to me. My friends and I speak in ironic cliches at cocktail parties we attend in the art world, cruising for important collectors and curators. If you don't like my work, it's because you don't understand it. If you want to get it, however, you have to master the specialized discursive dialectic found sandwiched between ads for high fashion in the pages of Art Forum. For every moron like you who says my work sucks, there are 1,000 super serious art writers who will use a wall of art words as the framework to slip in a little of their own poetic prose, serving not you, but serving me and themselves, propping up the central regime in New York and Washington by telling you over and over again that if you don't get the art, then you are too stupid for art, and thus another avenue of expression and the propagation of ideas is closed to you. I am a product of this culture, and my work and the machine that propagates it are what my art world has to offer, a tepid critique of the dominant culture and vast fields of alienation. My art does not celebrate because I have nothing to celebrate. My art is not interesting because my culture is dead. It was then that I knew that I could leave New York and the New York art world behind completely, for it certainly had nothing to offer me. I could leave now and never look back, but for by then, I'd been fortunate enough to go to Burning Man. yanked into the melee by the scruff of the neck the previous year, by a friend from the future that I'd met in the past, who knew as I did that despite all the fine advances that Western culture provided us with, like science, for example, and the principles of reason, there was something lurking in the warp and woof of the human experience that simply was not being addressed by the global megaculture that we had created. A 10-day rave, I scoffed. Exactly what I fucking need. If only it were that simple, he said. You simply won't believe me until you go. And by then, I had seen it. Seen an arts festival where no one handed me a business card, where no one listed off their arts school pedigree, where no one gave one shit if the work was archival, because most of it would be burned at the end of the week. It was an arts world where attendees were also participants, where art on the walls could only be there if someone bothered to build walls.
Woo!
A world where even if 90% of the work was utter shit, it exuded a deep desire to be understood, to be appreciated, to instruct and inform just as eagerly as that other art seemed bent to confound and confuse. Off Playa, however, one still needs work to look at, and in late 2001, I began to catch a glimpse of the work I wanted to see and see more of. I was in an opening in Santa Fe when I saw something that knocked my socks off, aesthetically and philosophically. It was a large-sized canvas with a black background, on top of which was printed a Hopi Kachina figure. Silkscreen nearby, on the same canvas, was a giant blow-up halftone of the Chanel No. 5 logo. The artist had several other pieces with similar juxtaposition. A Kajari trickster figure and the MTV logo, the Hopi butterfly and a Ferrari logo. In that work, I had seen, for the first time in my life really, even growing up in the Southwest, within 52 miles of 23 different Pueblo cultures, an instant glimpse into another world, the hybrid reality of contemporary Native American people, many of whom live, work, and breathe, and bathe in U.S. monoculture, while at the same time cling, praise the goddess, to pre-Christian conquest spiritual systems that make even the weirdest New Ager seem almost sane by comparison. In the Hopi worldview, the totality of the conscious and subconscious sensorium is represented by the Kachina Pantheon, a league of superheroes numbering at least 400 major icons. These would include spiritual beings such as Kashare, the trickster, and Iototo, the leader, as well as more pedestrian folk like Field Mouse, Butterfly Maiden, Squash, and Mother. Each year between February and July, the Kachinas leave their fortress of solitude atop the San Francisco peaks, which form the border between the Hopi and Navajo reservations, and fly into Hopi for a season of dancing. Incarnating themselves into the bodies of the human members of the Hopi Kachina Society, they reenact various mythological rituals whose origin dates back to at least the time of Homer, an oral tradition as rich and developed as any Greek tragedy. To see the juxtaposition of a Kachina and a corporate logo struck me as no small affair, a signal of sorts, that while my pagan roots are mostly a product of conjecture, wishful scholarship, and outright fantasy, here are a people living in our midst whose genetic memory and actual contemporary ritual practice dates back to the time before Northern Europe took over the world, before Christianity spread like a virus throughout the planet, before, and yet, they too were living like I am in this modern world, not tromping through the rough of the jungle in loincloths, but driving trucks and listening to 50 Cent and going to Dairy Queen and using interest-free checking to pay for it all. I had to know more, so I began to look deeper. Back on the playa, an evolving aesthetic keeps developing. Burning Man is the tabula rasa, the place, says I, where society goes to dream, and the overall collective, derived from the best and the brightest, or perhaps just the wildest and the craziest, of mostly California subcultures, punks, goths, ravers, hippies, all with aspirations towards a verifiable meaning in their lifestyle stances, are hurled together into the crucible that is the middle of nowhere, hammered by wind and dust and heat and cold, rain and forgotten items, the need to reach out and borrow, trade, barter, and give to all sorts of silly strangers from other scenes. An incredible cacophony of bridge building and increased tolerance occurs here in what I've lately come to call the white man's powwow. In the process, art is created, though bear in mind that the vast majority of artifacts created by this temporary culture could not really be classified as art outside this context. Remove the object from this place and it makes no sense, because it mostly references a conversation that only makes sense here, and many of the things that we take pictures of and bring home are less considered great because of a singular flash of inspiration than as a refinement of what began as a rather dumb idea. L-wire on a golf cart being a primary example. Most string it up and turn it on, and it works as radical free expression because of the guidelines we've set up here. Some, however, take the L-wire wiring of golf carts to new extremes, modifying the cart into the Starship Enterprise or a pink bunny festooned with neon. But off the playa, it's difficult to pull those moments from the gestalt that went into it and at which it is at home. If I had to narrow down Burning Man's aesthetic to two greatest influences, it would be a short list comprised of two people. One whom most everyone knows, and one whom most everyone does not know. The one everyone knows is Moby, master electronic musician, whose main instrument, so to speak, is a sequencer, a device designed to allow people to create both music and art and film and most everything else in a step-by-step manner that has evolved a rapidly changing music whose evolution is really just a modification of the initial incarnation. In other words, it's an aesthetic that fits perfectly in the playa, whose inhabitants seek both maximum efficiency and comfort without ruthlessness, improving one's camp and clothes and stature while still being nice to people. No easy feat by the end of the week, to be certain. The other influence is Hakim Bey, who is probably read by every early citizen of Black Rock City and is completely unknown to most of today's finest participants. In his seminal text, The Temporary Autonomous Zone, Bey advocated an approach to art which resonates throughout Burning Man culture, a kind of anarcho-situationist immediatism, one that encouraged both the temporary autonomous zone which Burning Man exemplifies beyond a doubt, even with the rules and regulations that have developed within it, as well as the creation of work that, be it large or quite dinky, should be treated as but ephemera, a notion flickering in the wind before the burning of the man. Thus, the best art on the playa, the showpieces which inspire both those who attend and those who catch it later in story, photograph, and film, is just not permanent. In keeping with the major underlying philosophical tenets that I've plucked out of the air and outlined here, works like these achieve greater complexity with each passing year, and yet are burned to the ground because fire isn't just part of the performance of the work. It is the contract that ensures that what is made on the playa stays on the playa. And if you want to experience the art, you have to come here and participate. And that's too complicated and outside the rules of art commodification for the mainstream art world. And thus, never the twain shall meet, but should they? I'm doing a phone interview with Walter Bigby, a Comanche photographer who was raised as an urban Indian just outside the Beltway and dropped into New Mexico in his early 30s to learn all he could of his past. He is a walking treasure house of native skills. He makes his own moccasins, builds his own drums, breaks horses without hardware, and is considered an expert in brain tanning, a skill which so puzzled me that I simply had to ask him what it was. "I tan hides with the brain of the animal it came from," he said. There's a rule of thumb to brain tanning, that any animal has at least brain enough to tan its own hide. Bigby and I shared a lot on the phone as we spoke, about our mutual hometown of Alexandria, Virginia, about his strange journey to acquire the skills of his people, about his search into his heritage. And once I'd gathered all I needed from him to write his profile, I began to say goodbye and he said, "But wait, what about you? Why are you looking to me and my people?" And before I could answer, he spoke again in a sing-song voice. "Do you know your songs? Do you know your dances?" These are standard questions in Indian country, when people are trying to ascertain the authenticity of the Indian in front of them. The full sequence goes something like this. "Do you know your grandmother? What is your clan? Do you know your songs? Do you engage in ritual? Do you know your dances? Are you a part of your community?" For a brief moment, a song danced in my head, an ancient track from the orb segued into Rhythm as the Dancer. My dances dance with passion and fire and ecstasy and speed across 1,000 mesa tops and right here on this playa. Stars burning bright overhead, wind whistling gently on cool desert nights, both at home and in Black Rock. 10,000 party people twirling glow sticks and poi people patterns, twirling, no dance known really, just the twist of the body, forcing it up till dawn to feel the triumphant moment of having found a thing lost to us a long, long time ago. "My songs and my dancers are at least 9,000 miles from here," I said, making a guess at the drive time between Santa Fe and County Roscommon, smack in the middle of Ireland. "But even if I were to return to know my true past, I would find nothing. My people fell to British rule in 800 AD. Your songs and dances may be the closest I ever get to a pre-Christian, pre-conquest reality." Bigby paused. "Crazy," said he. I never thought of it like that. Maybe that's why I'm so popular in Europe with the Germans and the French. Think of it, really. If you want to catch a glimpse of what it might have been like to have lived in a world before monotheism, before capitalism, before private property, one might look at the Native Americans of the southwestern United States. Despite invasion and conquest in 1492, many tribes still maintain their songs, their dances, their kiva societies, with some, like the Hopi, enjoying a more or less unbroken chain of what can indeed be described as a pagan culture. Never conquered by Christians were the Hopis, living on their mesas, articulating their worldview with each passing year through song and dance, passing on themselves and their cultural belief from one generation to the next until now, when a long-haired Kachina dancer can share a canvas with a Ferrari logo, illustrating the moment of hypermodernity when all that we have to offer as a culture goes up against their greatest philosophical achievement, and we fall flat. Flat as the silkscreen which printed it, and yet it is that very flatness which pushes us back to the playa every single August, looking to learn new dances, looking to learn new songs. I haven't yet been out to see Ukrainia. I may go tonight, but I avoided seeing it so far because everyone claims that it is simply the best piece of playa art that has ever been made. And I want to savor that moment. See it when I've got nothing at all on my mind. Like David Best's temple project, it seems to be one of those rare pieces of playa art that transcends the localized creative dialectic and might be something that belongs in the contemporary art landscape. But of course, like all great art at Burning Man, it too will be burned and will never tour the Whitney and will never appear in the U.S. Pavilion of the Venice Biennale. But the question remains, should it? And should anyone within this world, this secret society, this underground, this Croatoan, this tabula rasa where all icons of our collective unconscious are writ large against the desert floor for but a week, should these objects even attempt to seek to transcend this crucible, which nurtures it, and seek so-called greater glory on the playing fields of a culture that we know in our hearts to be dead? I, for one, think not, for Burning Man is not an incubator for the culture at large, but a cultural milieu on its own. It is a true alternative for the moment, so to speak, a crucible in which new ideas are born. What happens on the playa stays on the playa, for it is here that we know our songs, here that we know our dances, here that we cobble together an understanding of ourselves in both the petty subcultures and the greater cosmos towards a cultural heritage that cannot be found only in our past. We too are a hybrid culture, standing on the edges of those logos, staring deeply into the eyes of our own personal Kachinas.
Oh. Woo! Woo!
Welcome to, let's do, you can do that, but let's ask questions. You're going to start in five or something?
Whatever you want. You're the boss.
Well, no, but you can ring him in, but do folks have questions, comments?
Friendly.
It's all right, we had a series of disasters here anyway. There was a storm and everything.
You can get the podcast.
Any questions? Oh, there's a lot in there.
Sorry.
And where is Ukrainia?
It's the Belgian waffle.
The Belgian waffle.
It's called Ukrainia?
It's called Ukrainia. The time zone for a land that... Ukrainia. It's the name for a time zone for a time that does not yet exist.
I think it's Ukrainia.
Ukrainia.
For Kronos.
That makes sense.
That's good.
Yeah, but they literally spelt it for me on the ground, and they used an A. They said Ukrainia.
Well, the logo that they have on the side of their vehicles has an O.
It does? Oh, wow. All right, then maybe they misspelt it, Ukrainia.
That's Belgian.
Sounds better, Ukrainia.
They were fucking with me.
And that would make sense, the utopia of no place, Ukrainia, no
time. Come on in, folks. All right, Eric? Rang your bell. Okay, everyone, thanks, Gregory. It was incredible. It was fucking incredible.